agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
Love the government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to the Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, professor of political science at Northern Kentucky University. I'm joined today by my conservative counterpart, Cleveland area attorney and defender of freedom, Jay Carson.
Hey, good morning, Mike.
Hey, Jay, how are you doing this morning?
I'm all right this morning.
Yeah, I'm hanging in there. I'm doing okay too. Before we get going this week, we want to thank all of our supporters on Patreon who make the show possible. And of course, when you're a Patreon supporter, you get our regular show, you get our bonus show, which we're now releasing at the same time, so you can have just gorge on the Politics Guys every week if that's your choice, and all kinds of different things at various levels of support. And to check that all out, just go to patreon.com/politics guys. And if you want that bonus show, but you can't, you're not in a position where you can afford to support the show financially right now, send me an email, mike@politicsguys.com, and I will get you all set up with that. And if a monthly pledge, too much of a commitment, gosh, you don't need another commitment in your life, you can always do a one-time support through PayPal or Venmo, where we're at Politics Guys. All right, so today we are going to be talking about a bunch of things, including the results of the Cyber Ninjas, I'm going to do this air quote, audit at the COVID roundup, a bunch of things about COVID, as like the Pfizer vaccine booster and President Biden's pledge to put out another 500 million doses of vaccine worldwide, some immigration issues, the collapse of Senate policing negotiations, the debt ceiling, and the fiscal year 2022 spending bill, and the retirement of Ohio Representative Anthony Gonzalez, and what this might mean.
That's a lot of stuff.
Yeah, you know, it is. And there's no way we're going to get to all of this in the regular show, so we will move that stuff onto the bonus show. And so I'm looking forward. I'm excited about talking about this stuff. But before we do get to this, we just need to take a quick break, and we'll be right back and get things going. So before we do get to that first story, that Arizona audit cyber ninja thing, I wanted to take a little bit of time and talk about what we're all about here at the Politics Guys. And I think the reason why I feel like this is particularly important for us to do now is that, as listeners know, in the last few weeks, there's been some, I would say, not insignificant blowback concerning remarks Kristen made about COVID vaccines. And we're not going to get into that specific topic or Kristen's views on it again. I think Trey and Ken did a great job of getting into that on last week's show. But what I think we should talk about is the larger issue here. And that is what it means to be, as we say every single week in the intro of the show, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. And this isn't just a Kristen thing either. I mean, Jay, you're regularly attacked for what listeners sometimes call bad faith arguments or mindless, I guess you could say, shilling for what's often called Republican propaganda or, you know, GOP talking
points. Which is sort of ironic in a lot of ways, but yes.
And you know, I've come in.
Goes with the territory.
Well,
wear it as a badge of honor.
Yeah, well, and, you know, I've actually come in for some criticism, too, though. Usually it's because I'm not seen as challenging you or Kristen enough. There was a comment this last week on the Bipartisan Politics Reddit group that I am allergic to challenging conservative propaganda, and I have been since 2016. And it was a pretty popular post, got a lot of upvotes, and I thought, wow, have they heard what I've said about the Trump administration and all that? But, you know, so
guys, you should have known him back when I did, back in the late 80s, early 90s. I mean, you were all about conservative propaganda.
Oh my gosh, yeah. But you know, Jay, we've talked about cancel culture on the show before, but usually we've talked about it as it relates to other people and not our own hosts. And our audience is, of course, as you know, Jay, more liberal than conservative. And so you and Kristen end up with...
I've gathered that.
Yeah, it's a disproportionate share of criticism. And one of my concerns is that what I've seen over time is we've had some conservative listeners who've just basically backed off and, you know, stopped following, listening to the podcast or commenting. And this is actually something I've seen in my classes where conservative students have come up to me and said, you know, I'd be interested in talking about this, but I just don't feel like I'm in an environment where I can say this without being called a fascist or a racist or something like that. And this is a real problem. And I thought maybe since you're the one who tends to get the brunt of these attacks, that we could kind of start with your thoughts on this and what this is and how you feel about it.
Well, you know, I think there's something that has happened. And I read an interesting article the other day saying, well, it happened in 2015 at some point that, you know, where the switch got flipped. And I think a lot of folks, particularly younger ones, grew up in a living in a different world with different assumptions than what we did. And again, it's weird because I don't consider myself old. I suppose many of our listeners may. But then, you know, in the 1980s, 1990s, the Academy was very much, you know, within the liberal establishment, right? Colleges and universities and the press were all still very much what you associate with your, you know, the Democratic Party and the liberal talk. And when I say liberal in there, I what I mean is more what we would call progressive now, right? And so I don't want to get my terms mixed up because sure, that will become important in a minute. Less than a minute, actually, because the commitment that these institutions had was still towards the bigger idea of liberalism, as we use that in a political science-y context, right, of classical liberalism. And the tenets of that liberalism, and this is stuff that grew up in the early 18th century, late 17th, early 18th century, and was really sort of the intellectual framework for all of Western civilization that we've had, and you know, for the last 300-400 years. And it's sort of you don't always meet those goals, right? I mean, it's sort of the rule is more proven in its exceptions, but the basic tenets of this are the idea that individuals can speak and think freely, and that this is a good thing, and that this disagreement, this discussion back and forth, is the pathway to one. I mean, if you're thinking in bigger philosophical terms, you know, truth. Right, that you have these two competing views, and you talk it out, and you get to what is really essential and what holds up and what doesn't. In the more prosaic sense, I think the argument has been this gets you to policy outcomes that are, if imperfect, still accepted and have a legitimacy to them, right? Because, you know, you may not agree with the final decision, but you can agree with the process that everybody got that there was a fair hearing, everyone got to be heard, and you know, your side wins and maybe got some concessions on the way. Regardless, so you and I think come from that background, right? I mean, it's sort of we're swimming in that water and have been.
Well, you know, I would just add more than that is I seem to recall back when, as you pointed out, back when I was a fire-breathing conservative far to the right of you and, you know, certainly to the right of Ronald Reagan and practically to the right of Attila the Hun. You remember that. I mean, you know, I was the guy who suggested burning tires on Earth Day. I mean, I was a nut, you know, but but the point is it was more of kind of like a happy warrior sort of mentality, if you will, a little deranged at times. I certainly was, but this what frustrates me about what I see currently is this automatic assumption that anyone that disagrees with me must be arguing in bad faith or stupid or evil, and not that they just need to be educated, or maybe that they just see the world in a different way. And that's what happens all the time, because I hear people, when I make this response and talk about the exact same things that you do, people agree and they say, yeah, but the stuff that Jay or Kristen or these other conservatives are saying, this isn't true. These are just lies. This is just propaganda. And what's frustrating to me is, sure, people lie, right? Or people speak things that are not true. But you need to think about, well, where is this coming from? Are they intending to deceive? And sometimes they are, but in many cases they're not. You know, there's a great quote from Richard Feynman, you know, the famous physicist, says, yeah, the first principle is that you must not fool yourself, and you are the easiest person to fool. And it seems like it's so easy for us to forget that very true principle. And so we just assume, well, you know, our ideas, in fact, we're all, you know, well-intentioned, and certainly we couldn't be wrong about anything. And it seems to me what most people want is either they want a partisan echo chamber, or they want a tame conservative or a tame liberal, you know, someone that puts up kind of token resistance, basically, which is exactly why
sort of the straw man type.
Yeah. Which is exactly why we started the Politics Guys back in 2015. You know, I remember listening to some so-called bipartisan shows and just thinking, these are awful. This isn't real debate. This is and calling you up and saying, hey, do you want to do this? And you, yeah, sure, let's try, right? I mean,
and, what could possibly go
yeah,
wrong?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I was curious. This week I looked to see what the most popular politics podcasts were, at least on Apple Podcasts. And it's like, it's all echo chamber stuff. You know, this alt-right conspiracy theorist guy, someone named Jack Posobiec, I don't know. Pod Save America, which is, you know, super progressive. Bannon's War Room, which obviously goes the other way. And if you go down almost all the top political podcasts, it's clear most people don't want to have their views challenged. And they're just not interested in really seriously considering or trying to understand opposing viewpoints. That's what we're all about. That's what we've always been about. And the fact of the matter is that's why we're always going to be a niche audience. We're never going to be a top 10 or top 50 podcast, because most people aren't able to handle with or aren't in a place where they can deal with the sort of thing that we try to do. And as you point out, Jay, it's an ideal, and we don't always do it. We get some things wrong. Sometimes we could push back more or make better arguments. But you know, and I think in the end, this is why I'm so grateful for the listeners who do support us, because I know that the people who engage in the cancel culture stuff and all that on our show even are a small but vocal minority. And that's why I really, as I said, really do appreciate the listeners who've been supporting us and keeping us going, because there aren't many of us out there, folks, you know? And so the fact that you come back week after week and you appreciate what we try to do and understand that, you know, we're flawed human beings and we appreciate constructive criticism, and that, you know, sometimes we're going to make arguments, either whether it's me or Jay, that, you know, maybe you're not comfortable with, but the vast majority of you have told us time and time again that that's what you really appreciate about the show, that you do, that we do occasionally challenge your views and make you think about things. And that's what we're all about. And I just wanted to take a few minutes at the top of this show to remind people of that. And for people who are maybe new to this show, let them know, give them sort of some of the history there. And I guess mostly just to thank our listeners for being willing to engage in that, because it's hard work, and we appreciate you doing that work with us. So there you go. All right. So moving on, I wanted to talk, before we actually get to that, I guess we should say that this was a late breaking story, but as you may have heard, the cyber ninjas, so-called cyber ninjas, released the results of their so-called forensic vote audit in Maricopa County, Arizona. I should say the inexperienced and unqualified cyber ninjas, but that name sort of suggests that, I suppose, you know. But anyway, the results were that actually, surprisingly, I would say, more votes for Biden and fewer votes for Trump. And the report stated that...
Does that speak better? Does that now speak better of the Cyber Ninja's experience or integrity?
Well, you know, and I think my main takeaway from this is this means nothing, because this so-called forensic audit was riddled with problems, as both Republican and Democratic voting experts have been pointing out since this whole fiasco started. So it's meaningless, right? But still, the fact that this highly partisan vote audit showed didn't find any fraud, you know, I think when they were clearly looking for it, is pretty telling. Arizona's state Senate president, Karen Fan, who was instrumental in authorizing this so-called audit, she said, you know, truth is truth. Numbers are numbers. And so there you go. I mean, but I guess more striking to me were the sort of deranged, and I'll call them deranged statements that President Trump made on his website, which is sort of his now, I guess, his replacement for Twitter. And there were some fascinating things there, just really disassociated from reality. One said, massive fraud was found in the Arizona forensic audit, sometimes referred to as fraudit. The numbers are election changing. And then he mentioned, I won't even go on, but it just seems shocking to me that the president could be, not, it isn't shocking. I mean, we shouldn't really be surprised that he's so just deranged and disconnected from reality, you know, saying that the media is misrepresenting this. It's a big win. Now, one thing I agree with, he said the audit was a big win for democracy, but he says it's a big win for us, shows how corrupt the election was. It's a bigger scam than even anticipated. And he calls them the winning results of the Arizona forensic audit. I don't even know what to say about this. I mean, there's lying, and then there's just delusional behavior. What do you make of those comments? And there were more, but I just kind of highlighted some.
Yeah, I think we discussed this. My day, if I had to mark a calendar, was probably about January 3rd. And I think I may even said it. We may have had a show that day. After I read the transcript of the Georgia phone call with the Georgia Secretary of State, that I believe that Trump really, in his own head, thinks he won. And the only reason, according to his logic, that he could not have won is there must be fraud somewhere. And that fraud is evident to him, even though it is not evident to everyone else, including people who would be predisposed to find it. So I sort of fall on the deranged side, I think. I mean, again, it's you know, what we're doing is pure speculation, because we can't get inside his head. And unless there's some sort of secret transmission emails from Trump to someone else saying, hey, I'm just going to totally lie about this. And I know I lost, but I'm going to keep this alive as an issue. You know, and look, no, yeah, in truth, because there could be a little bit of both.
Sure.
Right. Yeah. And that, so it's not to say it's always one or the other, that it's deranged and a conscious attempt to deceive. It can be sort of both. And I think maybe that's what's going on. But the problem that Trump has, and here's the, you know, this kind of goes to the earlier discussion we had a minute ago, that the beautiful thing about liberalism, and again, this is liberalism in the broad sense, and this idea of, you know, let's everyone have their say and whole say what you need to do and make your arguments, is that you do get this stuff hashed out and reach a consensus. And the person who keeps making that argument, despite the consensus, it's a big political drag to them. It gets harder and harder to say, yes, there's this fraud, when, you know, first of all, the official results say X. Second, the results of people from, you know, officials within your own party. And I'm thinking that now, like Georgia's, you know, Raffensperger, a Republican Secretary mm-hmm. of State certifying results. Then you get to, Vice President Pence, you know, certifying results. And then you get even to this independent audits pushed by partisans to find fraud, and you still can't find it. That's telling. And look, this is the way we do democracy, and it's kind of crazy back and forth. But you know, at the end of the day, you get to the situation where the facts are what they are, and just frauds and conspiracies that are that massive. It's really, really difficult to run them, to operate them, without some piece falling apart, without somebody changing their mind, going to the press, after this process, right? You can have more faith in the legitimacy to say, yeah, look, this, you know, Biden won the election because everybody's looked at it every which way. And even the people who might not be looking at it honestly say that Biden still won the election. So.
Yeah, except, you know, I believe that there are tens of millions of people who will believe, as former President Trump said, the fake news media refuses to write the facts, thereby being complicit in the crime of the century. They are so dishonest, but patriots know the truth. Arizona must immediately decertify their 2020 presidential election results. And people are going to hear that. He mentioned he's going to be at a rally in Georgia, which he said will be packed, of course. And, you know, that's the truth, that they're, because they have their own truth, led by, you know, the most dishonest president we've ever had in the history of this country. And my concern is not so much, well, it's still with Donald Trump, because it remains to be seen how much sway that particular individual is going to have going forward. But to me, the larger ramifications. You know, in Texas on Thursday, the Secretary of State's office said they're going to start an audit in four of their largest counties. Now, of course, Trump won Texas, but Biden won, I believe, three of these counties. And this announcement came just, I think, a few hours after President Trump or former President Trump called for an audit. And we have these other partisan so-called forensic audits in a bunch of states, you know, Michigan, Georgia, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. And to me, this is the worst thing that can happen, and this has always been my larger concern about Donald Trump, is that it starts to normalize this anti-democratic, anti-liberal behavior, going back to your point. And that, to me, is the real threat to democracy. To me, the real threat to democracy from Donald Trump always came from these kind of larger ramifications, though certainly from the man himself.
So I disagree with you on that, in that my sense is the more people you have looking at this, the better. And I think in Trump's situation, I think we're already starting to see his sort of, his, you know, like Spinal Tap said, his appeal is growing more selective, in terms of, you know, the numbers who are showing up at these rallies. Obviously he'll say it's packed, but you know, that's Donald Trump. And I think it's kind of baked into the cake there, right? You know what you're dealing with. The other thing is these audits are, they're not free. And as partisans at some point, especially the Texas one, I don't particularly get, right? I suppose someone just has some money burning a hole in their pocket, that they're going to do this to audit results that, literally, and legally could never make a difference, right? After you've won the state, sort of be like, well, we didn't win it by enough. Well, again, it doesn't matter. And I also think there's a role for partisanship in keeping the other side honest, because another core principle of liberalism is that you don't really trust the government. And I think that's particularly true of sort of the American version of liberalism. So I think it's a good thing that you have dueling folks. Now, if you're constantly calling into question the legitimacy of certain institutions,
right? That's what I was going to ask about.
Then you don't have the proof, and I get that, right? That's a problem. But at some point, you get this kind of boy who cried wolf type situation. And I think that's what you're starting to get with Trump, of, oh, there's fraud here. There's fraud here. And they're just, there just isn't, when no one can find it. And I've made the point again and again and again, and I will always make this point. Was there fraud? Yeah, sure. There's always fraud somewhere, right?
Yeah.
People work really hard to do this. That said, is, you know, fraud on the level to turn a presidential election, particularly this type of presidential election. Now, it might have been something different, say 2000, when you're down to one state and you got, you know, things are going to swing 500 votes one way or the other, that you could steal a presidential election. But in this case, where you're talking about five states and tens, hundreds of thousands of votes, the type of fraud, at least that I'm familiar with, you just can't really operate it on that kind of scale.
But to me, the larger issue, and this reminds me of something that Senator Ben Sasse said after the 2020 election. He said, you know, it's really convenient, essentially, to say that, well, people are talking about election fraud, so and so we must therefore do things to lock down our elections because people are talking about it. People are concerned, when really what's going on, at least in his argument, was that these concerns are being made up out of whole cloth, essentially, as a justification for doing these things that many people on the left certainly believe have the effect of tamping down, suppressing, making it less likely for more Democratic, large D Democratic voters to vote. And that's the concern on the left. And I think my sense is that if, to the extent that that's going on, you certainly would be a very strong opponent of that sort of thing.
I am a opponent of that sort of thing. But I'd point out that 2020 was unprecedented in so many ways.
Sure.
Because of the pandemic.
Pandemic, yeah.
And as we've talked about when we talked about the Texas bill and the Georgia bill, there are a lot of things that we wouldn't have accepted, procedures we wouldn't have engaged in any other normal year. And then so I think there's reason to be a little skeptical, right? To say, oh, we're doing, you know, this is the biggest mail-in vote ever. There's this fundamental change there. And I think it's appropriate to be skeptical as to, is this a change, a good change? Does this change allow for more or less security?
Yeah. And I'll go even further.
I think there can be a good argument that said, look, a lot of the stuff that happened, you know, drop boxes and the midnight drive-throughs and this kind of stuff, those were things that did not have sort of the security testing, the well-worn sort of, look, we've been doing absentee ballots for 47 years now or something. The type safeguards. And I think it's not unreasonable to say, are these new procedures really subject to the safeguards? And I understand what you're saying. You can't just make something up and say, listen, people are talking, I hear this is going on, so therefore, you've thus called into question the election integrity, and therefore we need to do the X, Y, and Z. But I think in this case there were people. I mean, look, I was a little concerned about the gravity, the extent of all of a sudden mail-in voting,
and I think part of
some kind of ID type thing. And so you know, look, things like putting your last four, your social or a driver's license or something like that, the mail-in voting, I think those are reasonable.
To
safeguard the vote.
I think just like so much of our political debate, it's portrayed as, you know, extremism on both sides. It's either Jim Crow 2.0 or it's massive election fraud. And there, I mean, that, you know, that's both of those things, I think, are just way out of touch with the reality. But so many partisans see this, and so many, I would say, dishonest people in positions of power say, hey, we can use this, you know, to gin up some support, to get the base riled up, to boost our fundraising numbers. And that's the sort of thing that I just find to be, frankly, despicable.
Yeah. No, and I'd agree with you there. And this goes back to, we're having all kinds of like thematic cohesiveness on this show.
Yeah, there
you go. We're really proud of me. going back to, you know, one of the reasons we started the show, and one of my reasons, when you mentioned that we're going to throw that out at the beginning, one of the big things that occurred to me, And look, one of the reasons that you and I can talk about these things the way we do talk about them is we sort of have a shared understanding of the process and how it works and what's normal and what's not. And we have that background. There for reasons that would be a whole other show, and whether it's you know, social media, whether it's a failure of our educational system, whether it's whatever. I think there are a whole lot of folks out there who don't have that same common understanding of, look, here's what the Constitution says, or look, here's how the process works, and in that gap, right, is the invitation to demagoguery.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's interesting, Jay. A lot of this, I'm teaching a course called Democracy in America, where the main textbook is, you could probably guess.
The Tocqueville.
There you go. And this so lines up with so many of the things that he writes about in the book. And I actually thought one of these days, Jay, at some point, it would be really, I think, a lot of fun and really, I think, a good thing for us to maybe do like a series of kind of book club shows on democracy in America. I think that would be something we should maybe put on our list, because this really, it really speaks to what he was saying back in the 1830s, really speaks to a lot of these things still today. I think that'd be a fun thing and, you know, worthwhile thing for us to do.
Absolutely. And you know, something, again, and I don't mean to take shots at our audience, but
certainly not.
Turnabout's fair play, right? You and I both, you know, when you said democracy in America, I immediately knew what you were talking about. And I immediately knew you were talking about Alexis de Tocqueville. And I immediately knew you were talking about the 1830s. And but not everybody has that same thing that you're bringing in. And so often, again, that's more of a funny historical political theory type discussion. But it goes to the same thing of when we talk about court decisions, right? And it was something that always frustrates me is, you know, headlines that say court sides with X over, you know, whatever the issue is. And that bothers me in the sense that, well, the courts just here, you know, it's just like they're voting on, or they, you know, just picking the side, you know, when there's really a whole lot more that goes into
the sort of decontextualized, ahistorical view of these things that, I totally agree.
Right. And so when we started this show, that was, you know, I think part of my motivation, and because I believe this from a conservative standpoint, the more people know about how government actually works, I think the more they're going to lean towards my side and my solutions. And I think you sort of believe the same. But that's sort of the good point there, right? Is that, look, both of us agree that more knowledge about how stuff actually works is better. That's a little bit of a sidetrack, but I think that goes to the point of that's where you get this demagoguery, whether it's from politicians or whether it's from social media memes.
And knowledge, not only that, but regularly challenging what you think you know, because one of the best ways to sort of really understand what you know and to increase your knowledge isn't to engage in some sort of closed loop type of thing, but to get out there and that back and forth, because if you do that in an honest and open way, you're inevitably going to find that some things you thought were right are not quite as right as you may be thought. If you never change your opinions or your positions on anything, that's a problem with you, not a problem with the world. Unless you're a perfect being.
So this is another great sort of quote that I came across. I was on a webinar with Eugene Volokh.
Okay.
Who is the Volokh conspiracy and a law professor at USC, somewhere in California, somewhere warm and sunny. But he is, if you ever listen to him or read his stuff, listening to him, watching him, He's one of these guys who's like just five kinds of brilliant, right? And I think he had like a chemical engineering degree from like MIT when he was like 16 or something before, and then he decided to go to law school. But he pointed out sort of this was a discussion of our current moment in the law and politics, and something that Oliver Cromwell wrote back in you know, whatever, 16.
Yeah, there you go. 40, exactly.
45-ish, right? Before he launched the Civil War. And this was a situation where Cromwell was reaching out to a cleric who had disagreed with him, and he was going to getting ready to go to war with him, didn't really want to. And Cromwell wrote, "Would you please reconsider? I beseech you to consider. I beseech you from the bowels of Christ to consider that you may be mistaken." And I think that's just really something, and I kind of like live with that almost every day. I mean, maybe I should seek therapy for it, but but right. I mean, there's always that, yeah, that question of the, what if I'm wrong?
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
And I think that is a key to, you know, liberalism and this open discussion and this sort of debate that we have is that,
well, the lack of humility
sort of incumbent upon you to feel like, but what if I'm wrong?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and it goes to me that, you know, I always think of it in terms of intellectual humility. The lack of humility just in general in society and politics is striking, especially if you look back to, you know, previous age. You're a big, you know, you certainly are a big fan, and you're a student of 18th century American history, the colonial period. And there was, in the 18th and even in the 19th century, I think, a noticeable, at least in some figures, in some quarters, intellectual humility, and humility in general was seen as a virtue. But now that's just not really so much of a thing, you know, and exemplified by the, you know, by, I think, Donald J. Trump. And it's really, you can't do away with humility as a virtue in society and not expect to have a lot of really negative consequences. And I think we're seeing the results of that. So there you go. All right. Well, let's move from Cromwell.
So, yeah, long story short, Biden won Arizona.
Yeah. Okay. There you go. Yeah. So before we move on, we just need to take a quick break, and then we'll be back to talk about all things COVID in the last week. Hey, Jay. So we have, as usual, some COVID updates we want to get to. So why don't you kind of kick us off with our COVID news for the week?
So the general COVID news, and again, when we do these updates, I typically am ill-prepared to hit the big stories like this. But the United States is reporting more than 2,000 deaths a day as of last week, and that's up 10 times the death rate from July. So that gives you a sense of the volume of the problem. In that context, late Thursday, CDC Director Rochelle Walensky overruled its agency's outside advisory board and backed a expansion of booster shots. This would be inconsistent with FDA's. I was going to say FTC, but I'm like, that's not right. The FDA's approval of booster shots for those 65 and older or otherwise at risk. And the idea, and this is sort of an interesting sort of debate, right? So there's evidence that basically, if you've received one of the Johnson & Johnson, Pfizer, Moderna vaccines, that was, since the numbers seem to show that is 80% effective at keeping you out of the hospital.
Well, that's a moving target. Yeah. I mean, yeah, those numbers.
Well, it's a moving target. But I think there are a whole lot of folks who would look at this and say, well, yeah, but I'm looking for more than just not being hospitalized.
Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely.
and I think that's sort of, you know, the COVID booster could boost your overall immunity and your likelihood of transmitting it. So I, you know, this was, Mike, I guess let me pitch it to you this way. What's your thought on CDC director overruling? Because this goes again to sort of the liberalism kind of stuff. The CDC director, a political appointee, overruling the scientific experts.
Well, I'll point out that she only partially overruled, because the main thrust of both the CDC and the FDA were giving or approving vaccines for people over 65 and with underlying health conditions for younger. Now, the overruling part was about people whose jobs put them at risk for high risk for infection. And so I think certainly that is, that contradicts what the panel recommended, but there's also the consistency with the FDA, because it would be, I think, very problematic or potentially problematic to have one FDA recommendation and a different CDC recommendation. So I think there's a lot to be said for consistency. And secondly, I would say that it's considerably less than what the Biden administration initially hoped for, because back in August,
which was a universal booster.
Universal boosters for everyone after 8 months. And so it seems to me that you have to weigh a lot of things in this. And one of them is consistency. And one of them, certainly the main one, has to be what does the science suggest? And in terms of erring on the side of, well, both consistency and caution, I think that this makes sense, and disappointing to some people who would have wanted to get boosters. But it seems to me to be a reasonable approach. I don't really have any problems with it. It makes sense to me. The only thing I would point out is, there has been some opposition from, for instance, for boosters in general, from like the World Health Organization and other kind of global health organizations who say, there are many poor countries who don't even have enough vaccine for their initial doses. And, you're talking about boosters here. And that's, that's true, right? If you take a look at the world totals, currently 44.1% of the world's population is at least one dose of COVID. And this is according to Our World and Data. But only 2.2% of people in low-income countries have received at least one dose. And so there's a huge gap. But I think it's a fallacious argument to say that, well, these doses that would be going to boosters for Americans could be going for boosters to people in, say, Africa or Asia or something, because that's not really how it works.
It's not a zero-sum game in terms of boosters and the difficulty. So, and as you alluded to at in the original show intro, Biden has pledged 500 million doses to low-income countries. I've also seen another number that the total they have to get by the end of the year had been like something about 1.1 billion doses out there.
And I want to point out,
my sense is, we can walk and chew gum at the same time.
And, I want to point out that makes the U.S. by far the world leader in free vaccine distribution. As of early September, according to UNICEF data, the U.S. had delivered more than three times the vaccine doses of China, which is number two, and then Japan is third, not far behind. And after that, it trails off a whole lot. But it's really a difficult thing, because even though the U.S. has now pledged, the initial pledge was 500 million, and now, as you point out, brings it up to over a billion. As of September 20th, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation, total donated vaccine doses received, I believe it's from the U.S., is 141 million. And that's because there's a big logistical issue of going from of this, we'll donate this, to actually receiving the donation. I mean, China has pledged to donate 2 billion vaccines. That's, almost double what the U.S. has pledged. But to this point, again, as I said, they've only donated like a third of what the U.S. has. So it's easy to say we're going to do this.
This is not the United States being cheap.
Yeah.
We're saying we're going to prioritize our own citizens over others, which to me would be a legitimate, reasonable argument in any event. Right. But you don't have a CVS on every corner in Chad.
Yeah, exactly.
There is not the distribution system that we have here. There's not, as you say, it's logistical hurdles rather than being tight-fisted.
Yeah, and not only that, vaccines create special problems because, of course, two of the main ones, the Moderna and the Pfizer, require special environmental conditions. Exactly. And so I think that President Biden and the administration should be applauded for what they are doing, for being the world leader in vaccine donations and that pledge. And that's I think you would agree that this is a good thing that the Biden administration is doing, pledging to do for the world.
I do. No, I do agree. And actually, I would even go further and say I very much applaud CDC Director Walensky taking the stand that she did.
Yeah, there you go.
And because this go, I mean, this goes to something that you and I sort of sometimes disagree on is, look, the science is all well and good, but as in this case, you have scientists who can disagree. You can have data that is incomplete or inconclusive, and policymakers have to make a decision on that incomplete or inconclusive data. And that's what you have policymakers there to do. So I think this was the right call, by Walensky. I would be remiss, if I did not point out that, had this been a Trump administration, the headline would have read Trump appointee overrules scientists.
Yeah. Well, and to be fair, certainly in a lot of the accounts that I've read in the New York Times and the Washington Post, that was prominently mentioned. So there was certainly not ignored in those accounts. But, you know, the other part of this, Jay, is that there still are, and I would say, increasing calls for pharmaceutical companies to share their vaccine formulas, particularly Moderna, because Moderna got, I think, a total of $2.5 billion from Operation Warp Speed to develop and market and sell its vaccine. Johnson & Johnson also received funding, I think $1 billion. Now, Pfizer didn't participate. A couple of things I wanted to point out about this. Number one, none of these companies are legally obligated to share their intellectual property because it wasn't part of the Operation Warp Speed agreement. And so there's no legal grounds to force them to do that under that agreement, which is not to say that there's not, you know, a humanitarian argument. Secondly, I'd say that President Biden could potentially, there'd be some legal issues, force them to do this under the Defense Production Act, though under that law, companies would have to receive reasonable compensation
right.
for sharing.
Yeah. No, that's something different saying we're going to require production and you'll get paid for it versus we're taking your intellectual property.
Exactly. And third, I want to point out that Moderna has already agreed to not enforce its COVID-related patents, and they said they were open to licensing their COVID vaccine intellectual property. And to me, finally, I'll point out that the World Health Organization is working on a vaccine of their own that kind of replicates to the extent that they can legally do so the Moderna one, which seems to be the most effective long term, and then distributing that technology to any manufacturer that wants it. It seems to me, Jay, that the role for government here is to do things like encouraging Moderna and other pharmaceutical companies to license their technology. And I'm fine. I think it's great that the WHO is working on this sort of thing, but I would be really uncomfortable with a heavier hand approach of saying, of invoking the Defense Production Act in that sense. That's my take, and I wanted to get your...
Yeah. No, I would agree. One, I mean, I think the Defense Production Act, going back to what it was originally about was, you know, telling steel mills, hey, we need you to help us build tanks and airplanes,
yeah.
That sort of thing. So, first of all, I don't see the production is a problem, right? Like we just talked about a second ago, the issue isn't that there isn't enough vaccine being produced. It's that logistically, how do we get it to these places? And look, I would say in the United States, there are really no logistical hurdles. When I say no logistical hurdles, I mean, maybe you have to drive somewhere to get it. But there is an opportunity, reasonable opportunity for absolutely everybody in the United States to get the vaccine and or a booster, free with really minimal hassle on their own. So I think it would be legally quite questionable to invoke the Defense Production Act to send stuff for medical programs for overseas. But setting that aside, I agree with you that stealing intellectual property is absolutely the worst. And let's think about this. Moderna and Pfizer and J&J and all these other companies that even were unsuccessful, right? They freaking saved the world here. This is a really big deal. And they did so at great expense and great risk to themselves, their employees, doing that. And the concern that I always have as a free market guy is when the next thing comes along, if you do strip them of all their other rights, you do say, okay, yes, you're going to produce this, you're going to produce this for free. Are they going to be so willing to do anything the next time around?
You know, and I thought about that as well.
I get there's always the socialist type thing. I'm not calling you a socialist. I'm using that in a more general term of that everyone will work for the public good. But that just isn't how it works in the real world.
You know, I thought about that argument as well. But I would say that given the stakes, when millions of lives, when billions of lives are literally at stake, that I don't think that the big pharma would say, oh, sorry, we're not going to help out because I mean, they just that would not be allowed to happen. But the larger, I mean, the point about just in general doing this is it would make it more difficult. There would be maybe a little more resistance the next time around. It would be harder to get them to get started. There need to be more assurances made and that sort of thing. And so
you're not going to steal intellectual property, are you?
Yeah,
of course not.
Yeah. And that would delay things, and those delays literally cost life. So yeah, that would be a concern. The other point I would make is I do think actually it is a production problem, and that's because it would be better if every country had a lot of countries had their own production facilities where it could be easily produced and shipped short distances. But the problem is, again, we're not talking about widgets here. This is a highly sophisticated, advanced thing. And even in our country, Johnson & Johnson and I believe other companies had issues with bad batches and things like this. So it's not like you can just set this up like you're making, you know, nuts or bolts or something like that. And that's the real problem is in terms of getting this out. So even if
to me that argues against not to interrupt, but that argues against again the taking of any intellectual property, because you can have the secret formula.
Right.
But if you don't have the factory to make it, it doesn't
exactly
matter.
Exactly. And so I think the bigger issue going forward, and this I'm sure is something that the World Health Organization is working on, is making sure that there's better infrastructure in place so when the next pandemic hits, and there will be a next pandemic, and I'm betting it's not going to be another 100 years like it has been, you know, this time since the last one, that we're in a better position to make sure that these poorest countries don't lag behind so much. And, you know, that's always going to be difficult, certainly, but let's hope that works out that way. All right. I think we have time for one more story here. Before we do, let's just take a quick break, and then we will talk a little bit about immigration. All right, Jay, so there was a lot of immigration news this week, wasn't there?
There certainly was. On the first piece we're going to talk about, Senate parliamentarian Elizabeth McDonough ruled that the Democrats' plan to include pathways to citizenship for essentially would be DACA folks, certain farm workers, essential workers, other immigrants could not be included in the big $3.5 trillion spending package. She said that a policy change that substantially outweighs the budgetary impact of that change, and that change in the law to clear the way for this policy change is tremendous and enduring policy change that dwarfs the budget impact. So what that means is the immigration pieces, as they were proposed, at least currently, cannot be passed by a simple majority or a 50 vote plus Vice President Kamala Harris in the Senate. So they're either essentially out, or the Democrats have to come up with some new way to maybe try to massage this to make it more budgetary and less policy. I don't think there's a way to do that really, but they may try. So my view on this is that the Senate parliamentarian got it right. This is not a budget piece. It's a policy change, and I would think that's a not a hard call to make. But what are your thoughts?
I agree 100%. You know, it seemed to me from the beginning that this was not, that immigration reform did not belong in the reconciliation process. And these calls to fire the Senate parliamentarian are just eye-rollingly ridiculous. I get, hey, I am for. I like the underlying policy ideas, but the process is the process. And subverting the process, arguing that the parliamentarian made the wrong call, this goes to, well, you said we had this kind of thematic unity in the show. Again, you know, just if you don't like the outcome, saying that the process is rigged, no, I think it's a bad process. You know, I think the reconciliation rule is ridiculous. And the very fact that it exists points to, you know, maybe larger issues with the Senate. But the solution isn't
rules
to
is rules.
Yeah, the solution then is to change those rules, not to twist them out of all reasonable meaning. And so, hey, if you want to revise the Senate's rules to change the filibuster, that's a reasonable conversation, or modify this filibuster in certain ways. But arguing that, well, we have this reconciliation rule and let's pretend this fits under it, it doesn't. It doesn't, and this was the right call. And yeah, does that probably kill immigration reform? It absolutely does, and I think that's just heartbreaking. But, you know, the rule needs to be changed, not to be taken out of all proportions to what it means. So, yeah, we totally agree on that.
Yeah, well, good. So the next big immigration piece, and I have my music queued up, and now I can't find it, was happened down in Del Rio, Texas,
yeah,
where there was over the last 2 weeks, there's been a surge of 30,000, mostly Haitian immigrants. A couple of things have happened first last week. And to me, this is sort of separate from the immigration question, but there were media reports of U.S. Border Patrol agents whipping migrants with whips from horseback. That I think we can agree is false, based on the photos, based on the testimony, based on what Secretary of Homeland Security Mayorkas even said. These folks, the Border Patrol horseback, had long reins that they twirl to, as they explain it, to keep people back away from the horses to prevent injury. That did not stop President Biden and spokesperson Jen Psaki from sort of exploiting this, with Biden saying those people will pay. Those people, meaning the United States Border Patrol, not the folks illegally entering the country. So, Mike, what are your thoughts on that? And what message does that send?
Well, on that, I would say that even though Border Patrol agents were not whipping Haitian citizens, Haitian immigrants, or potential immigrants, it seems to me that certainly reasonable questions can be raised based on the video and images that have been, you know, around, that the way in which they were engaging or charging, what have you, these folks is certainly disturbing. It looked disturbing to me. And it's reasonable to say that if anyone treated these folks inhumanely, that they should pay. And I think you would agree with that. So I think it was,
yeah,
right.
No, I do. It is President Biden sort of prejudging the outcome when he says those people will pay?
I don't think so. I think that can be taken out of.
If I am in the dock for that, and they say, well, I said, what exactly is the process for this? And well, the president said, those people, meaning you, will pay.
Let's go back.
My sense of getting fair hearing is it's not going to be great.
Well, again, you know, and this goes back to, well, the Trump administration, right? I mean, and just politicians in general. They say they make these broad statements, right? And I'm not saying, you know, take Biden seriously, but don't take him literally, you know, like we've talked about with former President Trump. But, okay, it's a little bit of, you know, a political rhetoric, certainly, but it is not going to be the case. I feel confident it's not going to be the case that any of these Border Patrol agents who did nothing wrong will end up suffering consequences. Now, if I'm wrong about that, you will tell me that I'm wrong about that when it happens.
And, I will.
But, yeah. But
I've all been suspended.
To me, this is tempest in a teapot thing. The biggest issue The bigger issue is the larger concern about what's going on with the Haitian immigrants. For instance, we had the U.S. Special Envoy to Haiti, Daniel Foote, resigning in his resignation letter saying, "I will not be associated with the United States' inhumane, counterproductive decision to deport thousands of Haitian refugees and illegal immigrants to Haiti, a country where..."
Back to the country that he's in.
Yeah, a country where American officials are confined to secure compounds because of the dangers posed by armed gangs in control of daily life. So let's be clear here. Things are off. Even before this last year, things have been awful in Haiti. It's the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere.
Things have never been good in Haiti, ever.
They had an earthquake in August. There was a tropical storm, these powerful gangs that are controlling so much in life, lack of food and water, COVID. It's a disaster, literally. It's a disaster. And so it's absolutely the case where how can your heart not break at the thought of sending thousands of people back into those conditions? And the grounds under which, let's be clear, the grounds under which the Biden administration is doing this, it's based on the Trump administration public health immigration rule, Title 42, that allows the administration to send people back who are asking for asylum without a hearing because of public health concerns. And so that's what's going on. And
right. Yeah. And yes, we should be clear about this. These deportations are not immigration deportations in the traditional sense.
Right. Right. And, yeah. and so to me, I have a huge problem with this. I agree to a certain extent with Daniel Foote. And it's frustrating because it seems to me there are a couple of things going on here, I guess. One thing is that we do not currently have the infrastructure and the resources to house and quarantine all of the people who want to get in under these asylum claims. It seems to me that that's likely, maybe not certainly, but likely the case. And so then the question is, well, what do we do? Well, I could see it's an issue given the pandemic that you just can't, you know, let people, thousands of people into the country, not having any idea about their COVID status, given the fact that they're almost certainly not vaccinated, right? We know that almost for a certainty. And, you know, what the White House has said is that, well, you know, we assess these people for symptoms, and the intention for them is to be quarantined, and they're not intending to stay here for any lengthy period of time. And that's when I heard that, I thought, this is just doublespeak.
Yeah,
obviously.
The sense that these folks are just vacationing here.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it also seems to me difficult for me to believe that, given all of the logistical capabilities of the United States government, that we couldn't set up some sort of humane, temporary quarantine testing vaccine system at the border for this surge of people. Maybe we can't, but I find it very, very difficult to believe that that's the case. And so I just find this to be an unacceptable decision by the Biden administration.
Well, I want to put things in perspective, though, when we're talking about the deportations, which I do not find to be unacceptable. At this point, last numbers I said, of the 30,000 Haitians that have arrived more or less since the middle of September, 2,000 have been deported back to Haiti. So that leaves a pretty big number that have not been deported. And again, from the numbers I read, something on the level of 1,200 or 12,500 have been essentially released into the United States, pending at some point an asylum hearing, I suppose. Another approximately 8,000 have returned to Mexico, with likely the intention to try again. And there are another 6,000 or so that are sort of in process, I guess, right? That are being held and have requested asylum. And I'm not exactly clear with that. And also, it's not at all clear that those numbers really add up to 30,000. But that said, I guess that, like they say at the bar, Mike, I mean, you don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. And to me, I guess if sending someone back to Haiti, Haiti is absolutely a hellhole. But what's the alternative?
That's my point.
You said, look, if we could have some sort of humane quarantine facility, that also, in other words for that is cages, right?
Except it doesn't have to be cages. That's what I'm saying. I mean, yeah, there's something between putting people in cages and just sort of letting them roam about the country freely.
This goes back to my original question then of what message does it send in incentives? And when President Biden says, well, look, the border is closed, don't come here. But if you do, we'll put you up someplace pretty nice.
And I get that.
Get medical treatment. We'll get you, we're going to fire those mean Border Patrol people who tried to prevent you from crossing. We're going to lower the hammer on those guys, let me tell you. And we'll set you up someplace nice. And if I'm a Haitian and I say, well, at this point, over 12,000 of the folks who attempted this crossing, illegal crossing, are now in the United States. Free to go about, do whatever they want, pending some immigration hearing, probably next year, I'd say, my odds are pretty good.
I get that.
Right?
It seems to me, though, the argument boils down to then, well, if we make it clear to people who are suffering greatly that we will take care of them in a humane way, well, then more people who are suffering greatly will want us to take care of them in a humane way. And my initial thought to that is yes. Yes, to the limit of our capabilities, absolutely, we should do that. And it doesn't seem to me that we're anywhere near the limit of what we could do if we devoted the proper level of resources to the situation at the border. I mean, God knows we need more in terms of facilities. God knows we need more in terms of personnel. Our immigration court system is woefully understaffed and under-resourced. And so the answer to me is, this is not like it's a new problem, right? This is an ongoing thing. So the answer to me is not to take the Trumpian position of saying, you know what, we're just going to crack down and make it clear that you're not getting through and that will staunch the flow. And I think there's a logic to that, absolutely. The answer to me is just the opposite. To beef up our resources enormously so we can help more of the neediest of the needy. And that's the direction I'd like to see things go in.
So I guess my only response to that is I think it's sort of naive, right? Because what's going to keep happening is what has happened, right? When people will view the U.S. as having an open border,
let me stop you right there,
right? And say, look, okay, we'll give you an immigration hearing, we'll give you a quick immigration hearing. Still, a lot of those people who have fled here from Haiti, in a lot of cases, they didn't come directly from Haiti. They had been in a third country in Central America before that. What do you do? You say, look, no, you don't qualify for asylum, but yeah, your country's really crummy. So here you go. And at what point is that de facto a borderless situation?
Well, see, and I think there's a distinction to be made there because, we have to look at what the asylum rules, say, certainly, and make a timely determination as to whether people qualify for asylum under those rules. And reasonable people, I think, can have a debate about how generous our asylum rules should be. And to my mind, we should first off, make sure we have the capability to deal with all the requests that we have under the current rules. And I don't think you disagree that we don't really have that capability.
No, we don't.
And so, look,
we're stretched thin and we're spending, has federal spending gone up or down on this? It's gone up. I mean, we're debating a $3.5 trillion more in spending. To say we have, we have a lot of resources, but those resources are not unlimited.
I see it by, I think if we have the resources, I mean, I would say to, you know, if cut taxes by a 1.5 trillion over 10 years, we can certainly do this. This is not, in the grand scheme of things, this is not a budget breaking sort of thing. This is the right thing to do.
But it will be over time.
I don't think so. No, I disagree.
Because the more you encourage, do you think Haiti's going to get better?
Well, I mean, I think certainly.
You think a lot of these countries in the Central American Triangle are going to get better anytime soon?
Well, it might not be anytime soon, and that's why I think that we have a larger obligation to try to help, you know, to the extent that we can. Now, Haiti will get better, not maybe a whole lot better, not very quickly. It was hit with a lot of things all at once, and that's caused some problems. But, you know, in terms of what's our capacity?
I'm going to jump in one more thing. This is something that's always fascinated me about Haiti. Right. It's a divided island. Half of it is Haiti and the other half is the Dominican Republic. Yet we do not see a surge of immigrants from the Dominican Republic.
Yeah. Government matters.
The Dominican Republic may be someplace we would consider third world. It is probably does not have the amenities that we have here. But I don't think anyone would call the Dominican Republic a failed state like you would Haiti. So at what point does our obligation to provide shelter from every failed state in the world, at some point you say, okay, well, we could get rid of the tax cuts, but at some point I don't think it's callous or
I agree with you that we can't.
For me, ask why should I pay more taxes for these Haitians who haven't been able to get their act together since the 1700s.
Oh, it's not these Haitians.
The people living just across the other side of the island in the Dominican Republic have.
Yeah, well, it's not obviously these individual Haitians. You're not saying that, you know.
No, I'm saying the Haitian government.
Yeah, I want to make
the course that. Of, yeah.
And so I agree with you.
The actual Haitians are, I imagine, perfectly nice people. And they're responding in a completely rational way to the situation and incentives that have been placed before them.
Yeah. I would agree with you that we cannot do everything for everyone. And that's what you're saying. And certainly that's true. But I also think we can do a lot more than what we're currently doing. And so that's kind of where I land. And also I want to point out that this brings into kind of a third point about immigration this week. President Biden announced raising the refugee limit to 62,500, which is considerably more than the Trump administration's 15,000, but well below his campaign promise of 125,000. But if you take a look, and I know you've seen this data, at the refugee limit over time, back in the 80s, in the early 80s, it was well over 200,000. So we used to admit a lot more refugees than we did. And that's my point, is we can do a lot more than we're doing right now. You're right that we can't do everything for everyone, and there have to be limits. But the limits that we've set to this point are far lower than what we're capable of doing. And that's my point on that.
Yeah, so I have a couple ways to hit. One, back to the Haitians, and why not immigrate to the Dominican Republic?
You know, and I'll just leave
that out there, right? I mean, my sense is because the Dominican Republic is probably harder to get into than the United States. You could also make the argument, well, it doesn't offer all the opportunities the United States does, and that'd be a fair argument. But this is sort of a gratuitous, hitting somebody out once they've gone out of bounds. But I think so much of our immigration situation also flies in the face of the woke narrative that this is a systemically racist country.
How so?
Right. Because again, apparently folks from Haiti are choosing to immigrate to the United States. As opposed to somewhere in the Dominican Republic or somewhere else, that they oddly have not gotten the memo of what a horrible racist society we are, and they are willing to risk life and limb with Mexican cartel human traffickers across some of these. I mean, if you read the trip that these folks have taken through these rainforests, that's, you know, the most dangerous places in the world, from in terms of criminal operators, in terms of you know, venomous snakes, and you know, all sorts of horrible things to get here. I think that's
a stretch. I mean, I don't think if we had AOC stay on the show, that would be an interesting show. But yeah, I don't think that she would say, oh yes, the United States is worse than Haiti. You know, for people just in their general life. So
for people, well, for no, but if the idea is systemic racism, which that's all the rage these days, right? And it's so bad, it's baked into our constitution and so forth.
Well, I think you can believe that
these people obviously didn't get the memo.
No, I think that's a bad argument, because I think you can believe that. And to a certain extent, I believe that Well, you can believe that and also believe that the United States is a far better place to be than so many other countries in the world. And it's completely understandable why people from across the Western Hemisphere, across the world, would want to come to the United States. So I don't think those two things are in conflict.
That was the concession I was going for. My last point, and now I'm forgetting it.
Happens to me all the time. I just talk until something comes to mind.
I had three things I was going to say, and you sidetracked me on two. But well, it'll come to me.
It'll be part of the bonus show, folks. So in fact, we're running kind of long today. So why don't we end it there on that cliffhanger? And then in the interim, Jay and I will take a break, and he will recall what this thing is, certainly. But also
really good.
But we're also going to be talking about the Senate policing negotiations, the collapse of those, that debt ceiling concern, and the spending bill. Because, of course, the end of the fiscal year is coming up. And then something that's sort of close to home, but also national, the Representative Anthony Gonzalez announces his retirement. Of course, he was one of the 10 Republicans who voted to impeach President Trump. We'll talk about that and larger implications.
I've met him a bunch of times, Mike.
There you go. I've seen him on various Saturdays and Sundays, of course, playing football. So, but I've never actually met him. So anyway, that will be all part of the bonus show, which should be available to you, well, by the time you hear this. And if you are not a supporter and you'd like to become one, again, it's patreon.com/politicsguys. And if you'd like to get that bonus show but can't afford to support us financially right now, just send me an email, mike@politicsguys.com, and I will get you all set up. Also, if you haven't already done so, it would really help us out if you could subscribe to the show, leave ratings, leave reviews on the podcast app of your choice, and especially sharing episodes on social media. That is a big deal. It really helps us out a lot. And if you want to get in touch with us for any reason, mail@politicsguys.com is our address. And also we're on Facebook and Twitter. You will find links to those in our show notes. A special thanks to our executive producers, Bruce Johnson, Wilma Moreno, Andra Masker, Daniel Toe, Chris Wilkerson, and Ryan Beasley. We'll be back with a new show next week. We hope you join us.